Oh, the shape up or get. If you've let all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, welcome along to Team 33. I'm Raf Giallo. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at Team 33. That's all in words. We're also on Facebook and also on iTunes. We've just seen Ireland and Austria play each other on Sunday, and while the performance isn't inspiring, we will get on to the result and the implications and everything else and whatever we think of it. Joe Coffey's here, though.
Raf, of course, I actually missed pretty much all the game because I was at Mayo Galway.
Oh, of course, so yes.
You have a lot of insight into the game then, what happened. You pretty much didn't miss a whole lot apart from Ireland hoofing the ball long.
Yeah, Derek Ryan obviously had a great view of the match as well.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, you were actually there.
Yeah, it was disappointing to say the least. And Mayo Galway was disappointing as well.
Well,
so
I emerged fuming from Salt Hill after that 1-point defeat where Mayo seemingly...
You set yourself up for a fall every year. Oh, it's Mayo for Sam, then they lose against Galway in the... Is this their second game? They just have a game.
Yeah, into the qualifiers now. Aperture, they had umpteen chances to win the game, never mind draw it. And
the last minute they had a chance, is it?
They were 1 point behind with 8 minutes to, including injury time, 8 minutes to go, and they still didn't get a score.
They didn't score in the last.
But they were playing with 14 men for 50 minutes. Yeah. But anyway, because when I left Salt Hill, then I was parked up beside a hotel, so I went into the bar to see, and then I saw Ireland were 1-0 down. So yeah. I was like, Jesus. So then I decided to drive back to Dublin then, and I listened to the match on the way back. And then obviously they got the goal, which I saw later on from John Walters, and then the disallowed goal.
We'll get on to all of this anyway in time. Anyway, we do have a long form interview. Myself and Killian Woods recorded last week. We've been plugging it for a little while since we did. And it's a book called The Mixer, and the story of Premier League tactics from Route 1 to False Nines. The author is Michael Cox. I think anybody who reads The Guardian, ESPN, or even goes over to Zonal Marking, which is his, and is interested in tactics, he's kind of the go-to man when it comes to the Premier League. So we talked a bit about the things that are in the book, in essence, the development of tactics in the Premier League from rudimentary long ball 4-4-2 all the way to, you know, your Contes and your Guardiolas and everything else. And that interview is coming up right now. All right, delighted to be joined by Michael Cox, author of The Mixer, the story of Premier League tactics from Route 1s to False Nines. Michael, first off, I'm a massive fan of your work. I regularly read, I'd say on a weekly basis, your stuff from Zonal Marking and then also The Guardian and ESPN. And I think it's because tactics also have become, you know, it's something that we all kind of think about a lot more. And I want to start off the top, really. We're living in a kind of, we've just come off the back of a season where it's all been about back trees, and it's kind of moved away from the whole 4-4-2 ideas from over 20 years ago. In terms of the evolution and the use of the back three, or the increased use, are we kind of living in this peak period of, you know, tactical experimentation in the Premier League?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, based upon the first 25 years, I don't think the game's ever been so tactical. And I think this season was really interesting, or the season just gone was really interesting, because it was an example of how, you know, one manager, Antonio Conte, came over with, a system he didn't start the season with, but something he switched to after about 5 or 6 games after that Arsenal defeat. And I think by the end of the season, it was 17 of the 20 teams had all used a three-man defence at some point, which is amazing when you consider that, I think, 2011-12, there was only one team who used it on a regular basis, and that was Roberto Martinez's Wigan. Football just has become a lot more tactical over the 25 years. And that was something in the book that was almost difficult to explain in a way, because it's a history of tactics, and yet one of the things is that it's just got more tactical, which sounds like a silly thing to say. But you look back to the early days of the Premier League, and teams pretty much had one style. They played to the strength of their best players, and they didn't really vary things from week to week. Whereas these days, the level of opposition scouting and, you know, the data collection teams do on the opposition, and, you know, the type of managers we have now, it's just become a lot more studious and a lot more in-depth, and yeah, it's more tactical. tactically complex than ever before.
Yeah, and it's definitely progressed, because I can think of a time, having read before about, I'd say, the period of the 80s, and certain managers were influenced by a guy called Charles Hughes, and his kind of view was that three passes or fewer kind of lead to a goal. And I think we've people like Pep Guardiola in the Premier League now who, you know, espouse a style where it is about kind of keeping the ball and, you know, keeping possession moving. And the 4-4-2, it maybe seems a little bit much maligned, but I guess it's maybe the use of the 4-4-2 maybe that's more of an issue than the actual formation.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, you saw a team like Leicester last year who were broadly playing 4-4-2. I mean, I'd probably say it was more 4-4-1-1 with Okazaki dropping deep into the midfield. But, you know, obviously outside the Premier League, but a team like Atletico Madrid have often played 4-4-2 with great success. But it's a very compact 4-4-2 where the midfielders or the wide midfielders play very narrow and help out in the centre of the pitch. The strikers drop very deep, and so they're almost playing with six midfielders in a way, just structured in a basic 4-4-2 system. But I think when we talk about the 4-4-2 in a Premier League context, we're kind of thinking of, for example, the Blackburn team that won the title in 94-95. That was just very simple, two outright wingers trying to get to the byline and crossing the ball in, and what I'd call two number nines in Sutton and Shearer in the centre. I don't think you really get any teams playing that way anymore. Even a Tony Pulis side or a Sam Allardyce side are usually, you know, 4-5-1 or some other kind of combination. So that kind of classic 4-4-2 and the classic 4-4-2 style, as I would say, we don't really see anymore.
Yeah, and one of the things that did change, or at least saw a kind of change in style, it's the arrival of foreign players, and particularly the ones that kind of played as deep-lying strikers. And we're talking about the Cantonas, the Zolas, the Bergkamps. Exactly in what sense was it kind of the managers that helped them mark the shift, or was it the players themselves, their kind of individual styles, that had the biggest impact?
Yeah, I'd say more than anything it was the players' style, to be honest, particularly with Cantona. I mean, the interesting thing about Cantona's signing is that before Ferguson had bought him, and I think everyone knows the kind of almost fortunate story about how United landed him. It was Leeds inquiring about Dennis Irwin, and they happened to ask about Cantona. But Ferguson, before that, was kind of, he knew he needed a forward, but he was unsure about what kind of forward he wanted. So he was looking at Cantona and also Peter Beardsley, but also kind of classic number nines like David Hurst at Sheffield Wednesday and Brian Dean, who was at Sheffield United at that point. And he ended up getting Cantona for almost circumstantial reasons. And then, you know, you listen to all the Manchester United players talk about that period, and they say that as soon as Cantona turned up, he just showed them the way to play football. United had been a fairly straightforward 4-4-2 team before that, just going down the flanks with those, you know, with Giggs and Kanchelskis and Sharp and those kind of players. But Cantona meant that they basically started passing the ball through the centre of the pitch. And it was, I think, in the early days of tactics, or the early days of Premier League tactics, I should say, it was really more about the foreign influences on the pitch than the managerial philosophies, if you like. You know, Zola and Bergkamp, I think, was a similar thing at Chelsea and Arsenal. Arsenal in particular had been renowned for playing awful football throughout the first part of the 1990s. And again, Bergkamp came in and he just changed the way Arsenal played. You know, slightly before Arsene Wenger was there when Bruce Rioch was in charge, but Rioch put a big emphasis upon, you know, getting the ball into Bergkamp between the lines, even when he was struggling at first. And so, you know, people didn't really talk so much about managerial philosophies then. It was, you know, we were celebrating the players more than anything else. And so, yeah, the early days, I think it was basically the foreign players rather than the managers who really influenced tactics.
So, Michael, The Mixer is kind of a book that looks over the history of Premier League tactics. Is there anyone over the years you feel gets a bad rep for maybe not being perceived as tactically astute as they are? Like, maybe, I don't know if this would be an example, but Harry Redknapp seems to get a reputation for slapping players together and just hoping it works. Is that true? Is there anyone who has a bad rep?
Yeah, I think Harry Redknapp is a really good example. In fact, when you started that question, my first thought was Harry Redknapp. I think the funny thing is there's certain managers, generally kind of old school English managers, who basically don't want to be seen as tacticians. It's almost like a dirty word. And then you have a manager like Rafael Benitez, for example, who very much wants to be that studious kind of guy. But when you look at matches in depth, you know, there's some, I can point to, for example, when Tottenham won 3-2 at Arsenal in 2010, I think, late 2010, maybe 2011, and Spurs were 2-0 down at half-time, and Redknapp changed things and went from, I think 4-5-1 to 4-4-2, and it just changed the game completely. And Redknapp's actually very good at making kind of in-game tactical decisions. And then, yeah, on the other hand, you look at someone like Benitez, who was clearly a very studious manager, with someone who looked at the opposition in depth. But you look at the way that Liverpool won the two major trophies they won under Benitez, the Champions League and then the FA Cup. And I think it owed as much to kind of that classic old, dare I say, English spirit, English in inverted commas, of kind of never say die and never giving up and being driven forward by Steven Gerrard, who was obviously this kind of fantastically old school English player. There are another couple of examples. I mean, I think that someone who I've just mentioned, Bruce Rioch, often comes across quite badly in Arsenal's history because he was between George Graham and Arsene Wenger, who had great success. But he was really the one who started the revolution at Arsenal before Wenger got there. He brought in Bergkamp and encouraged Arsenal to play the ball into him. But he also focused very much upon two concepts. One, which was playing the ball out from the back rather than, you know, hoofing long balls forward into attack. And secondly, he really focused upon the importance of sharing goals around and not depending too much upon Ian Wright, who I think had been Arsenal's top goal scorer for the previous five or six seasons. But Arsenal didn't score that many goals overall. So when you look at the way football's played now and teams playing out from the back a lot, and also the emphasis upon strikers not just scoring goals but bringing others into play, it feels like Rioch in that sense was almost ahead of his time and played really quite an important role in the development of Arsenal into the kind of technical team we see these days.
You might agree with this, or maybe you would, but it seems like we have an embarrassment of riches of like tactically astute managers, managers who have led this revolution now, like Pep Guardiola and likes of Antonio Conte, kind of shaking it up and kind of defining the back three in the Premier League. Is it weird then for journalists as yourself when managers don't want to talk about this? It seems like Guardiola was a bit of a knockback, and Pochettino as well. They're put questions in press conferences about tactics and they kind of dismiss off journalists if they don't know what they're talking about. Is that a bit weird little paradox there?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that's a really good point. I think managers get frustrated, especially foreign managers that come to English football. If they come from somewhere like Italy in particular, to a certain extent Germany and Spain, where they're often asked questions about tactics, I think initially they find it odd that people want to focus upon gossipy kind of stories. But you're right. I mean, I almost compare it to the fact that, you know, if you see an interview with a musician, they generally don't want to talk in depth about the music. They don't want to talk about how they come up with the songs. It's just almost something that, I guess it's almost they want to keep secret, or it's kind of internal decision-making process. But, yeah, I mean, you know, I go to press conferences after games and sometimes ask the managers questions. And it's rare you get an interesting answer. I remember once after Rafael Benitez had just gone to Napoli and Napoli were playing in the Emirates Cup. Napoli had been playing a three-man defence for the last 4 or 5 years and Benitez was playing 4-2-3-1. And I asked a kind of general question that was, how difficult is it to move, you know, a squad that's been playing from three at the back to a 4-2-3-1? And Benitez just said, well, it's easy when we win and it's difficult when we lose. And that was that. And Benitez seems like the kind of manager who does want tactical questions. But when you ask him, yeah, like you say, they're often not too keen to answer.
Yeah, because it seems like a spot where they could kind of show off their intelligence rather than, as you said, whether player X is moving to club Y or whatever like that. Is there any managers who do give proper answers?
Pochettino can be quite interesting in that respect. I think he's keen to engage with those kind of questions. I'm starting to think in the Premier League, probably not so much. I mean, Sam Allardyce, when he won games, is very keen to talk about his tactics, not so much when he has it on his way. But no, there's a funny thing in English press conferences where the managers are very defensive. I think they're very focused upon not giving things away. And yeah, it's difficult to think of too many who really like to talk tactics. One who did like talking that way and obviously has gone a few years ago was Andre Villas-Boas. Was always quite interesting about his side's plans for the game. But not too many, to be honest.
Yeah, one of the most astute points I think I remember reading a few years ago, and it dated back from the early 90s, it was Jack Charlton, our former manager, our international manager here, and he was making a point about full backs and that it's the most important position in the game. And you actually look at how football has developed, not just here, obviously, but the amount, the way they exploit space has probably been one of the biggest effects we've seen. Even the Champions League final there, you know, you have your Dani Alves and such. In terms of the development of the full-backs, how has that kind of progressed in the Premier League over the space of time since 1992?
Yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting position. I think it's gone through many phases. I think when Jack Charlton was talking about that, it was it made a lot of sense, because pretty much everyone, at least in England or in British and Irish football, played 4-4-2 or 3-5-2. So the fullbacks would basically never have anyone right up against them. They'd have a wide midfielder to contend with, but he was obviously, you know, located very much in the midfield. And so then you did see the rise of very attack-minded players. You look at someone like Ashley Cole at Arsenal, for example, who started off as a forward in the youth team, but then was kind of told he wasn't going to make it in that sense and had to adjust and become a fullback. And then, you know, by the midpoint of his career, you never thought this is an attack-minded fullback or a forward playing out of position. That's just what a fullback was, because they were forced to be so good technically and so good on the ball. I think there was a slight shift away from that when teams started playing 4-3-3 and particularly 4-3-3 formations, because it meant the fullbacks now had, you know, often a very aggressive, a very quick winger up against them, often a goal scorer as well who could come inside. And so they then had to become, you know, very good at their defensive tasks again. And there was also a slight reaction to the attacking fullback, in the sense that we saw players like Park Ji-sung and Dirk Kuyt, who, you know, were really good, particularly in big games, those kind of big four games at the time. They're really good at nullifying the opposition fullback. And now I think we're in kind of a funny kind of situation where there's lots of different types of fullbacks around. Obviously, the shift to 3-5-2 changes things, because the more attack-minded ones become wing-back. Some of the more defensively solid ones have become a centre-back. And again, because there's so many different types of system, you know, they're forced to be very reactive and very adaptable. And sometimes they're playing up against a kind of inverted winger looking to come inside and shoot. Sometimes they'll be playing against a, you know, a 4-4-2 and they'll have more space to push forward. And it's kind of rare that they come up against the kind of classic old school tricky winger that they would have done back in the 90s, because you just don't really get those kind of players around now. They tend to play on the opposite flank and shoot, or some of them have become fullbacks themselves. So, yeah, it's been a really interesting position, and, you know, obviously not the most glamorous position on the pitch, probably the least glamorous position on the pitch, but so many developments and so many evolutions, and, yeah, it's just a really difficult position to play these days, I think, particularly because of the workload and the amount of running you have to get through.
Yeah, like the title of the book is The Mixer, and then also there's the word Route 1 in there, and there's this kind of, I suppose there might be a snobbery towards long balls generally, from what you hear from managers like Tony Pulis or Sam Allardyce sometimes, when they're asked a question about like their style of play, maybe when they're playing a Wenger or a manager of that ilk. Do you feel maybe the fact that sometimes some things become slightly more fashionable, maybe things like the long ball, which maybe become less fashionable, actually become more effective when they're, you know, in a period where everyone else is kind of playing the same?
Yeah, I think that's an absolutely great point. And I think we've seen that this season, or the season just gone, with Manchester City, where, you know, Kevin De Bruyne gave an interview to, I think, a Belgian newspaper. And, you know, foreign players in the Premier League often tend to be more open when they're talking to journalists from their own country. And he was saying that Guardiola was really surprised by how many long balls there were in English football. But that's kind of inevitable if you're going to play Claudio Bravo, who's a sweeper keeper, not a tall commanding keeper. If you're going to play John Stones, who's almost the defensive equivalent of that, very good on the ball, not great in traditional centre-back respects. And Alexander Kolarov at centre-back alongside him. They're three players who aren't particularly good with high balls, don't want to be going in for aerial duels. And, you know, managers aren't stupid. If they see a team, you know, coming to play them like that, then they're going to pepper them with long balls. So, in a sense, things can be kind of cyclical. And, you know, now that everyone's trying to play technical football, it does make sense to kind of, you know, stick it up them, to use another old-school English phrase. But there's also a big emphasis upon big clubs playing good football. And that means that, you know, lots of top teams are not going to revert to playing Route 1 football just because, you know, the opposition have a weakness. There's still an emphasis upon playing out from the back. So it's a funny kind of thing. Tactics is, you know, I guess tactics refers almost to a specific game, a specific approach. But I think teams are more concentrated on, inverted commas, philosophy rather than tactics at the moment.
Yeah, one of the positions I think we've seen develop over time is the so-called holding midfielder. I think Claude Makélélé pretty much gave it a name as well during his time at Chelsea and prior to that Real Madrid. And certain pundits of a certain era who would have played maybe in the 1970s and that don't really, they don't see the necessity for a pure holder. But then, you know, we look at the likes of Busquets, who are, you know, who does hold very well in front of defence, but is also good at recycling position or possession. Do we, are we going to see maybe a move away from a pure holder? Like, we're looking at Kante, who is definitely not that, and, you know, fulfills, you know, kind of almost box to box role in terms of regaining possession.
Yeah, I mean, it's another position that's seen so much evolution. You know, I think back in the 80s, the early 90s, it was probably true you didn't necessarily need a holding midfielder. But I think the thing that's changed is the speed of the game has increased so much. And, you know, teams are so quick on the counter-attack that you can't really have that old system of midfielders getting up and down the pitch in turn. And sometimes at the same time, because they just don't have that much time to recover the ground. And so increasingly did see the popularity of holding midfielders. I think Andre Villas-Boas summed it up very well when he was talking about his first few games with Chelsea, where he said at Porto, the system I used to use, there was a holding midfielder that he could go forward and someone else would fill in. But because the game is so much quicker in England, we just can't afford to leave the defence unprotected. So that kind of summed it up in a very, you know, very specific situation. I think it's a funny situation at the moment, again, because of the slight confusion with systems, or the variety of systems, I should say. If you're playing three centre-backs, then you can have a kind of a defensive midfielder, but someone who's a little bit more mobile in front of them. I think we have seen a shift away from that kind of pure holding midfielder, the player like Makalele, John Obi Mikel, Lucas Leiva. They're still, you know, some of them are still around, but I do think teams have moved towards wanting more mobile players in that respect. Even someone like Ander Herrera at Manchester United came as more of a box-to-box midfielder, but more often than not, I think, was United's deepest player this season, and wasn't a pure holding player. He was a tackler, but someone who got around the pitch as well.
Yeah, over the years, Michael, has there been any kind of anomalies of a team that kind of has been successful without kind of applying any tactical, having a tactical nous? I think I remember reading before that Newcastle didn't really seem to have, the side that nearly won the title there in the 90s didn't really seem to have much of a tactics. They just kind of went out and kept winning every week.
Yeah, I mean, I think back in the 90s it was entirely possible to play that way. I mean, Newcastle didn't win the title in the end, and I think to a certain extent you can say that was because of their tactical naivety. But I think it's worth remembering that Keegan had taken them from the bottom of the second tier up to second in the Premier League, and they did that really without any collective work in training. They didn't really work on, you know, game plan or patterns of play or set pieces or anything. It was basically just kind of five-a-side and shooting drills, and that was it. And Keegan's only kind of nod to the opposition was that he'd read out the team sheet before the game. He didn't say anything about their strengths or weaknesses or what they were trying to exploit. So obviously Newcastle came pretty close to winning the title. I think since then, it's been pretty rare to really have that kind of complete laissez-faire attitude towards tactics. I mean, again, Harry Redknapp kind of paints himself as someone who doesn't care about tactics, but he didn't do that much coaching. You know, he always had a really big coaching staff and some very bright coaches as well who'd work very hard on shape. I think maybe sometimes it's you look at someone like Liverpool in 2013-14, it wasn't that they didn't have tactics, they were actually very well drilled tactically, but their approach changed massively from what Rodgers intended. You know, he came from Swansea talking about possession football, and then he realised he had three very quick, good counter-attacking players in Sterling, Suarez and Sturridge to kind of completely change his tactics midway through the campaign. So you see some more of that, but I don't think teams are ever kind of unprepared in a tactical sense anymore.
I know the book is obviously focusing on the history of Premier League tactics, but maybe over the research for it, have you noticed, is there any gulf in class and tactically between the Championship clubs that come up and the Premier League? It seems like in the last few years, it seems like a lot of attacking-minded teams have come up through the Championship and it seems to have paid off for them.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I think in relatively recent years, there was two interesting ones. You know, Blackpool came up in 2010 and made quite a good initial impact with Charlie Adams' long-range diagonal passes from deep, so they were interesting. I think Swansea the next year as well were kind of perfect for that time. They came up when everyone was focused upon possession football. Obviously, Barcelona were dominating European club football and Spain were doing the same at international level. And I think Swansea had the second or the third best pass completion rate that first season after Manchester City and Arsenal, and you know, even though they've had the troubles in recent years, particularly this season, and I guess they've kind of moved away from that model slightly, but for a side like Swansea, a really small club, you know, they came up, they didn't even have a training ground when they came up. They were just sharing a kind of tennis club in Swansea. And their kind of philosophy and their emphasis upon playing a certain way has meant they've been a fairly, you know, consistent mid-table side ever since. And I think that kind of long-term tactical thinking is really useful for a club coming up from the Championship.
Yeah, I suppose a final point before we let you go, Michael. Looking sometimes at the past, maybe I was looking at maybe Totti as the proper first false nine I remember seeing, and then, you know, the back three, I know Napoli would have played it for a while, and then you see all this migrating into the Premier League. So do you think maybe we should be looking at Italy first tactically, what they're introducing, and then kind of looking and seeing what we can predict to see what comes into the Premier League?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, I think there's been various foreign influences in the last few years. I think you can look at Germany and their emphasis upon pressing. I think you can look at Spain and their emphasis upon possession play. They've become more kind of value concepts in English football recently. Italy to a certain extent. I think the problem with Italy is it's played in quite a different way from the rest of Europe. It's a lot slower in tempo. The players are very, very tactical, but I don't think they don't quite have the emphasis upon flair players that most of Europe likes. Italy traditionally haven't really done exciting wide midfielders very well. It's almost always about foreign influence. I think the sad thing maybe is that the Premier League has basically depended upon foreign influence over the last 25 years. I'm not sure it's given that much to Europe in the way of tactical innovations. We're very much a follower rather than a trendsetter. And I think that's probably more than anything because we don't produce that many great coaches. You know, obviously no Englishman has won the Premier League. There's no top British managers at the moment. I think the top eight this season were all managed by foreign managers. So we're not producing the coaches and we're not producing those ideas. And that's a bit of a shame. You know, I really like the kind of variety and the diversity and the kind of multiculturalism of the Premier League in terms of players and managers. But, you know, you guys probably won't be too concerned about this, but it's a shame that English football is not producing good coaches.
Yeah, certainly for English people, it certainly is. But anyway, Michael, thanks a million for taking the time to chat to us. The book is The Mixer, the story of Premier League tactics from Route Ones to False Nines. And thanks a million for taking the time.
My pleasure.
All right, so that was Michael Cox, author of The Mixer, the story of Premier League tactics from Route Ones to False Nines, which is out now in all good bookstores and online as well. And we'll be back after the break with Joe and Derek to talk about Ireland, Austria. So that's coming up afterwards. All right, welcome back to Team 33. So as we kind of touched on at the very top of the show, Ireland, Austria kind of leaves us in a slightly, it hasn't really changed much because
the other
result between Wales and Serbia also ended up being 1-1.
Thanks to Aaron Ramsey's, what do you call it?
Panenka, is it?
Panenka. Aaron Ramsey's Panenka, yeah. In the stadium where Panenka scored the first ever.
Oh, really?
Panenka.
Oh, I didn't know. Yeah, it was Mr. Panenka.
He's Mr. Panenka.
Oh, I didn't realise that. Yeah. I thought Panenka was some fancy foreign word for chip or something.
No.
He is
Mr. Panenka.
Yeah, former Czechoslovakian international.
Let's try and get him on the show, can we?
I don't know if he speaks English.
Hasn't stopped us before.
And my languages stop at English, French, Spanish, and then Czech isn't really, or Slovak, or either. Neither is there. Anyway.
In the post-match interview, one of the interviewers went, were you aware that, you know, Panenka, this is where the stadium where the goal was first scored? And obviously Aaron Ramsey was like, no. It's nice to score it though, I suppose.
He wasn't aware.
No, but who would be aware?
Like, I thought that's half the reason why it was kind of a tribute.
Well, I'd have to applaud Aaron Ramsey's encyclopedic knowledge of football if he was aware that that was
I didn't even know Mr. Panenka was a person, so fair play to him.
Yeah, but fair juice to him anyway.
It got us out of a spot. I think now it just means that nothing changes. That Serbia game is going to be the two games for, like, we're anticipating that we should beat Georgia. Even though, you know, going on our last performance at home to Georgia, nothing's guaranteed there, but we should beat Georgia. Yeah. So you're looking ahead and you're looking at Wales and you're looking at Serbia.
And you'll take 3 points from Moldova more or less because they've been beaten 3-1 away.
Yeah. So you're coming down to the Serbia game, obviously, is crunch game and the Welsh game. We need 3 points from the Serbia game and we need a point from the Welsh game.
You have to hope and presume we'd beat Moldova at home. Georgia away. If you get 6 points from Georgia away, it's big ass and we're on. But Georgia away and Serbia at home, we're pretty much through then, because you'd have to expect us to beat Moldova. And then we're 4 points. We're pretty much through in terms of actually we would have topped, we'll pretty much top the group, or at least we'll come second in the group. We're guaranteed to come second in the group.
Well, in fairness, actually, I think if we manage to beat Serbia, we'll probably get away with losing against Wales.
And top the group?
Yeah, to top the group, we'd probably get away with a loss against Wales if we managed to beat Serbia, because Serbia, obviously, that would give us the 3 point lead, assuming we win all our other games. And you would hope that, well, if Serbia could still finish level on points for us, then you'd hope we'd edge them though on goal difference.
You say nothing's really changed, and you're probably right, but you look at it in two ways. This result on Sunday, Austria not in great shape. They actually thought they were decent on Sunday at the Aviva. Alaba was quality and did a lot. He kind of controlled the midfield for me, but I thought they were decent, but still they have a lot of problems at the moment, and you know, we probably should have won the game. So maybe it's a missed opportunity in one regard, in terms of taking, especially with the way the other game went, in terms of taking a lead in the group and, you know, really kind of driving on and being in a strong position going into these last four games. The other side of things is it's one less game for us to, you know, things are exactly the same as we were before and we've got one less game to go. So like in a positive outlook, it's one less game for us to completely mess things up. If you're going to be negative about Ireland and generally what we do.
You were there yesterday. What did you make of it all? The atmosphere and everything.
The atmosphere was really good, actually. Despite the football, which was not good.
The atmosphere on Twitter wasn't great
but
at all.
But the stadium was really good, and
the start was very slow. Yeah, by all accounts.
Especially the atmosphere in the second half when we were kind of going for it. For me, Austria sort of decided around the hour mark. It was around the time that Darren Murphy came on, but around the hour mark they decided they were going to shut up shop. When it looked like they had Ireland there for the taking in terms of definitely scoring another couple of goals, and they had a couple of great chances. Darren Randolph made one really good save. They missed another one where...
did he actually play? Because obviously he's been under a lot of pressure recently.
He was one of the better performers,
We made that great save. And he had no real chance for the goal. I think he made one... There was one error, I think, from a corner that I think he didn't come for, but I think he was blocked in fairness. But apart from that, I thought he did pretty well. I never really expected him to be dropped. I would have been surprised if Westwood got in there ahead of him. That was all the talk beforehand, but I kind of thought that was just media talk.
But you do get the feeling that he's won if he does make a serious mistake.
Yeah, but I see...
Because he's had a couple of high profile ones recently.
I always say changing your goalkeeper is a massive call, it's a call that you don't make unless you plan on having that new goalkeeper in place for the rest of the qualifying campaign. But then O'Neill, during the last qualification campaign, he switched around
Germany game. That was Randolph's first game, I think,
Ford started the campaign. Given came in. And then Given got injured for the Germany game, and instead of bringing Ford in, he brought Randolph in.
I think that it's hard. They're hanging in there, isn't that what you'd really say?
Yeah,
like they're in a hell of a better position than they were at this stage in the European qualifiers, where they were something like fourth. They'd drawn with Scotland, and they were fourth in the group.
I think we all thought after the draw against Scotland. Or sorry, not the draw, the defeat to Scotland in the group, that was it for us in the last qualifying campaign. Yes, I think obviously there was the fact that the top two qualify and third gets the playoff meant we had an outside chance, and we took that outside chance. But yeah, I think the margins are a little bit tougher this time.
It's just since they got back from March onwards, you know, they finished everything on a high last year and they got back from March, the performances have been pretty average. Now, with that said, a lot of the we're well away from the highs of their performances at the European Championships. I mean, the performances have been pretty average since March. I mean, you had the draw against Wales, where they didn't really create anything of note.
That was overshadowed by the Coleman thing.
And it was overshadowed by the Coleman thing. They had this game where they seemed to get on top in the last 20 minutes, half an hour. Unfortunate to have the goal disallowed.
But like I say, a lot of that was down to, they brought on Darrell Murphy and then Wales came on after a while. But a lot of it was down to, for me, Austria deciding with about 60 minutes on the clock to defend and sit back and welcome Ireland onto them. Austria, for me, were the better team up to the hour mark. And then after the hour mark, they decided, it was like there was like 5 minutes left in the game. And, you know, they kind of invited pressure on them. And then Ireland started just
in fairness, pumping the ball along towards Murphy, towards Walters, and putting a lot of pressure. And they did put a lot of pressure on them. In terms of creating chances, not a whole lot of them.
No.
I think there was a couple of wayward shots from, I think Walters had one especially. The big thing, and I'm not one of these people, I always think it's hilarious how we kind of hold these players up who aren't playing for Ireland as if there's Zinedine Zidane. Andy Reid was that player for years. Dave O'Leary was the player for long time.
I know.
And Andy Reid, you swear Andy Reid was Zinedine Zidane.
Everyone gets better the longer they're on the bench.
Absolutely. And Wes is one of these players. I'm a big fan of Wes, and I don't see him, you know, everyone goes on about him as if like he is this player who could win the Ballon d'Or. But at the same time, I was disappointed to see him not start. And then after that first half, I just went, listen, this game is nearly crying out for someone to get on the ball from an Irish point of view. All we were doing is lumping the ball along. Literally, the ball was at right back. And I'm not blaming the players. This is obviously what they were told to do. Cyrus Christie and Ward and everyone, all when they got the ball, they were just pumping it along. Randolph pumping it along from kickouts, not even trying to play the ball out from the back. And this is obviously what they were told. That was the tactic they were told to do. For me, Wes should have come on at half time nearly. Darragh Murphy came on before him, which again shows what we're trying to do, which is pump the ball along towards Darragh Murphy as well. Then Wes came on and thought he did very well when he came on. I think the game was crying out for Wes from about the 45, even the first half, but certainly at half time. And when he came on, he did quite a lot.
Yeah, I think we can probably tease a bit more of that out, because Wes isn't the only player, I think, that when there's a period, when, for example, we're not playing the most progressive style of football, we're always calling for a certain player. Andy Reid was that before. So I think we can get onto that maybe a little after the break. Welcome back to Team 33. So before the break, obviously, you were talking about Wes and a game crying out for him.
He's Wes not Zidane.
Yeah, and we had that situation with Andy Reid as well when Trapp was leaving him out. And it progressed into like, Wes Hoolan as well.
It's a common thing across, I think, all sports, even... It really is. Even in GAA, I see it all the time, where particularly in my own county, Mayo, I do see that the players that aren't playing...
are suddenly world beaters, yeah.
Yeah, oftentimes. I think with Wes Hoolahan, his age probably does really count against him.
And his... Like he's great for what but like in terms of if you're playing... Obviously, Martin O'Neill felt that the Austrians were good on the ball and were going to dominate possession in a lot of ways, which they did yesterday. Alba was very good, and I actually thought Austria were pretty decent yesterday. I was expecting them to be god awful because everyone was talking about how awful they were, and they were pretty decent, I thought. But obviously he felt that he needed three lads in midfield who were going to be pretty much defensive football, or certainly at least fighting for the ball the way the three lads did in midfield. And Wes isn't that sort of player. He's not a combative player. So he obviously felt that we needed to kind of shut Austria down more than we needed to be creative.
Which is a pity, though, when we're at home and we beat them 1-0 away.
And we didn't have Shane Long's pace up top either, which was, you know, if you're playing that style and then you can pump the ball out, you know, Shane Long's pace can be a big danger in that regard. We didn't have that. John Walters, who did a great job for what John Walters can, and John Walters is great, but he wasn't able to maybe make the runs and, you know, make the breaks, I suppose, that Shane Long can make. So, yeah, there was... I think I can see why he didn't play. You know, he didn't start. I was surprised he didn't start, but I can see why he didn't start. But my point was, after 45 minutes, this is not going well for Ireland. Austria are all over us. Let's try something. Now, in fairness, they brought on Darragh Murphy and he did fine. So I'm not suggesting that it was the worst decision in the world not to bring on Darragh Murphy, but I just felt the game was crying out for Wes. And, okay, fine, don't start him, but surely after 45 minutes you can see this game needs Wes. And he didn't come on for another few minutes after that.
Just one thing on that, though. Like, Wes Hoolahan and Andy Reid, the main advocate. common theme.
Absolutely. Well, Andy Reid especially. Andy Reid went...
Jamie Dunphy.
Absolutely.
And, like, is that the reason why everyone ends up saying, where's Wes Hoolahan and where's Andy Reid? Because ultimately, let's be honest, the vast majority of people...
Eamon Dunphy's a fan of Wes Hoolahan. I have not noticed that at all.
No, but the vast majority of people who watch Ireland games, they'll be watching them on TV. So ergo, they'll hear what Eamon Dunphy is saying. And is that the reason why... Like, that must be... Like, that has to be the reason why everyone ends up going, where is Wes Hoolahan in Europe? Or do you think differently? Same with Andy Reid.
Oh, it's absolutely 100% it is. Yeah, yeah.
Like, if Eamon Dunphy wasn't talking about Wes Hoolahan, it's probably fair to say the vast majority of people wouldn't be talking about
him. I think the vast majority would. Yeah, I think people would still go, listen, he's a creative force and we're not creating a whole lot. But certainly there wouldn't be the big call for Wes. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Yeah, absolutely. And Eamon, but like, whatever it was. But Andy Reid was a good player for Ireland, but nothing more than that. And like, if Andy Reid had been dropped by Trapp, you know, properly and maybe phased out of the team or whatever, you wouldn't have said much. It's just the way he was dropped. He suddenly, there's a big issue about it. But and Eamon took this upon himself to be, you know.
Well, the reality is that the one difference I say, I suppose, about Wes Hoolihan and Andy Reid is like, Wes Hoolihan is still playing pretty high level football, whereas Andy Reid kind of disappeared.
Andy Reid is fine. Don't get me wrong. He should have been in the squad at the very least, and he wasn't for whatever reason. Obviously, Trapp didn't trust him, didn't like him.
He was like the next.
He became a better player in his absence.
Yeah, he was Messi. He was pushing Messi for Ballon d'Or for a few years, according to Dumpy.
He was going to be like, he was like Damien Duff or something like that's what he was. Was Andy Reid left winger or midfielder?
He was right wing. He was kind of right wing, and he sometimes played in the 10 role.
Yeah,
it depends on if you wanted our wingers to track back. Andy Reid did not track back, so he used to play a kind of bit further.
I can hardly remember now. So long ago, that's a decade ago.
The 06 World Cup, that campaign, he was a big player for us.
Yeah, it was just he was there at the very beginning of the Trapp era, but then I think a guitar was taken out or something.
I think that was an excuse.
I
can see why, you know, Trapp wants his players to work hard, and Reid wasn't the sort of player who would burst his balls to get back, you know what I mean, in terms of defending. But like, he was a very good player for under Brian Kerr. He's one of our most creative players under Brian Kerr, and the 06 World Cup campaign and stuff. But and understand maybe this moment as well.
It's very much a case as you were. I think it's going to come down to those two huge matches, assuming we don't screw up the other two games.
It could be done and dusted by the Wales game, and you'd have to hope we don't go to Wales needing a win.
I really think that the Serbia game, it's all or nothing at the Serbia game.
Yeah, absolutely. And Georgia away, the last thing you want to do is beat Serbia at home, but having lost to Georgia away, or even drawn to Georgia away, depending on other results. But then Wales have to win, and Austria have to win all their games. I can't see them doing that either.
Hopefully we'll have better run with injuries.
And I was nearly looking at the game, sorry to go back to the Wales thing, but nearly looking at the game yesterday going, this sounds bad, but I nearly wouldn't mind us losing today. Because the game on Sunday, where, Ireland got a result, despite the fact that they didn't play well.
I have to wonder where you're going when you say it before we lost.
Say it again?
I'm going to have to wonder where you're going with this when you're saying I'd nearly perfectly
lost. No, but we didn't play well at all, but we got a result. So this kind of vindicates Martin O'Neill for not playing Wes and for playing this really poor style of football. Got a result. Great, we got a result. Now again, I don't want us to lose, obviously, but my point is, you nearly want us to get a last minute scrambling goal that wasn't deserved and get the result. You know what I mean? Because I just kind of feel like it nearly vindicated Martin Lee yesterday that we should have won the game, because the second goal could easily have gone in. We could have won the game.
It's true.
And then we nearly won the game. I'm not going to say it was by luck, don't get me wrong, but still, it wasn't by playing great football. It was kind of by doing something.
No, like, if that had been a goal, I mean, it was a ball that was bundled home into the net. Yeah,
but you know what I mean? Like,
I know one of the Austrian players said that we're lucky it was a Spanish referee. If it had been a British referee, it would have been a goal. But I mean, to be honest, I would reckon if we had conceded that goal, we'd be pretty miffed if it was allowed.
Oh, yeah.
We'd be annoyed.
No, I can see why it wasn't given, in fairness. Yeah. My point is that Martin O'Neill will see can use this and say, listen, this system's working. We have, like, it vindicates my decision not to play. We can play a whole lot better, but we're not going to play a whole lot better. We have Hendrick, who plays Premier League football, hasn't been great since he moved to Burnley, but still Premier League footballer. Brady, Wes, Long wasn't fit yesterday.
Hendrick hasn't played well since the Euros. He was good in the Euros.
Absolutely, he was great in the Euros.
In a diamond, but he's not playing in that system.
Yeah,
now,
and then
so works.
So we have players, I think, that we can play a lot better, and we're just not. For whatever reason, Martin O'Neill's a manager, he knows what he's doing. My point is that maybe a loss, or, you know, not even a loss, but a very lucky point may have seen Martin say, listen, we need to change things around here because we can play a lot better. And the fact is that the narrative is now we weren't lucky to lucky not to win, you know what I mean? So that's kind of frustrating, because I can see us definitely playing that way against Serbia at home the next day, and Georgia away, which I can understand Georgia away. You know, this kind of makes, that kind of information makes sense for Georgia away, because it's a tough place to go and all that kind of thing. But like Serbia at home, you kind of feel like maybe we should be maybe taking the game to them. After that result yesterday, you can see them definitely playing the same information against Serbia at home.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just this campaign, like, I'm really happy with the number of points we picked up, but I still, you know,
I hope we make it because I think
absolutely.
I actually
don't get me wrong.
I'm starting. I know it's your way, but I'm actually starting to look forward to the World Cup. I think it'll be good. I mean, the World Cup will be kicking off this week next year. It's a late start.
But I can't remember us playing or, you know, having this much control over our own fortunes in the qualification campaign ever. So that's what I'm saying. We're giving Ed a bit Martin O'Neill the playing style, and then we're in a great position in the group. You know what I mean? So you can't give out too much, I suppose.
As an aside, what did anyone see the last 20 minutes of the England-Scotland match on Saturday?
No, I did, yes.
I was watching Tipperary against Cork, and when that finished, I switched over and got the best part.
Lee Griffiths.
It was actually unreal. It was insane last few minutes.
Yeah, no, it was a good game. That part, but anyway, not the first half. I pretty much saw most of the second half.
I couldn't believe it. Like when the second one went in, I mean, they definitely should have won. I think though, looking at it, you have to say, I don't think this is a very good England team.
No, like there's a lot of kind of half decent young.
Do they have great players? I don't think they do.
A lot of the players are there. Like we. I mean, I didn't see the game, so I can't comment. But I'd agree if we're talking
about a team that can compete to win the World Cup, they're not at it. Yeah. They're definitely not there.
But you look at the players that they have. Again, I didn't see the game on Saturday, so I can't really comment. But you've got the likes of Harry Kane, like the Spurs spine. You've got Dele Alli. Did he play?
Yeah.
Harry Kane. You've got Dyer there. Like you've got,
but then they have Joe Hart, who's well out of form, either well out of form or just is dipping in the ability.
Walker and Danny Rose, who are both pretty quality fullbacks.
But it's not like you're talking about like Danny Alves at his peak or anything
like
that.
But like you're not.
I mean, like
they should be better than they are. My point is, okay, maybe that shouldn't win the World Cup. But they should be better than they are. And
well,
according to Twitter, if you weren't reading between the lines, but England have won the World Cup now. Obviously, in brackets, it's the under-20 World Cup. Yeah, it's still a great achievement. But
it is a great achievement.
Some of the headlines were just they left out the under-20 bit. They might throw it in as a hashtag.
But like, if you go back to 2002, 2006, when they had this amazing group of like this team wouldn't be anywhere near them in terms of ability. I don't think.
Not individually, no.
Now collectively, we'll see. They got out of jail against Scotland. I mean, they're top of their group.
Yeah, they'll coast there. They'll be there.
It's a fairly uninspiring.
They do that's the frustrating part about England. They coast to their group, and that's why everyone goes, "Oh, we're going to do it this time," because the amount of times they get either close to or actual maximum points in their qualification campaigns, and they ease through the group, and then in the World Cup they come up against someone like Costa Rica and can barely score a goal. So I just
don't see where, even from a tactical point of view, I just don't see where their potential improvement is going to come from.
Yeah, no, I can't. It'll be maybe a second round quarterfinal exit on penalties.
Yeah. And you see, actually, the under-20s keeper made a penalty save at the weekend. And again, they went crazy. It's like, this is our fortunes have changed. We're going to win the World Cup on penalties.
Yeah, well, other than that, it was just a penalty during the game against Venezuela. But anyway, that's it for this week's show. Derek and Joe, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you.
Take it away, Johan.